kitchen. There's hard to be raining her do.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the one country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Jordan. How are you doing tonight? Thanks for joining us. I think it's going to be a wild hour, shall we say. Coming up February 8th through the 10th, it is the Healdsburg Wild Steelhead Festival. Now, I say trout. You say salmon, we all say steelhead. What's the deal? Can we work that part out? And you know what we didn't do, Lawrence? Look, the mics are flying right over the guests' heads. So you're going to have to listen to a little bit here, a little bit of mechanics here while we get the microphones into. There we go. Well, that's a first in mouthful. And on that note, I'm just going to go around and clockwise and have y'all introduce yourself. Chris?
Hi, good evening. I'm Chris Mattson. I live in Healdsburg, California. I am with the Healdsburg Lodging Coalition. I own the Irish Rose Inn and can't wait for everyone to book all the rooms this weekend at our different inns. And we're going to have a wonderful time up there.
Great, thanks. Okay.
Hi, first of all, thanks for having us. I'm Rob Dickerson. I work for Trout Unlimited. We're a national cold water fisheries conservation organization. And my role with that organization is to work with members like Kent, who's also here, and then private landowners to do fisheries restoration work on the North Coast. And Trout Unlimited does other work throughout the country.
Okay, and Kent McDougall.
Well, I'm Kent McIntosh.
I'm McIntosh. I knew that.
Oh, you did? Okay, thank you. And I wear a number of hats. I'm the president of the Redwood Empire chapter of Trout Unlimited. I'm also a fishing guide on the Russian River, and my portion of the festival will be facilitating the trout pond for children.
Oh, cool. Now, let's get this issue settled, trout or salmon. How do you understand? I was so used to, for a long time, people saying steelhead, and just by default, they meant salmon. But it's trout, right?
It's trout. And actually, we're talking steelhead trout, and the difference actually is a steelhead is a trout until it goes to the ocean. And if the trout does not go to the ocean and return, it becomes a rainbow trout.
That's if it stays in freshwater, it stays a rainbow trout.
That's correct.
Okay.
Right. And if it goes to the ocean and returns to spawn, then it's a steelhead trout. Okay. But it is a salmonid, which covers salmon and trout. Okay.
And what determines if it goes to the ocean or not? Whim?
It's probably deeper than that. There's a little biology involved, and I don't know.
Actually, the main thing is that it needs water. Fish. The one thing that fish need is water, so it's critical that there's water in the streams for the fish to be able to migrate within the stream, and then also to have the ability to go out to the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and along with water, there's also a question of they have to be able to eat, and so they're pretty voracious eaters. They're great predators, and there are the ocean offers a better source than a small creek.
So it's really their hunger that sort of drives them to just keep going and going and going. And the next thing you know, a rainbow is a steelhead.
Right.
Okay, that's really interesting. What percentage, say, around here, or in general, maybe this isn't even a fair question to ask, but what percentage go off to become steelhead? What percentage stay rainbow?
It's a difficult question because we actually have two different types of steelhead in the Russian River. Okay, we have a wild native steelhead. That population is much smaller than the mitigated or the hatchery steelhead, which are essentially cultivated up at Don Clausen Hatchery. Okay, and so they do thousands of them. I don't know that we have in the Russian River system, I don't know that we have 3,000 wild steelhead, to tell you the truth, native to the Russian, okay? But do you know the numbers? What Fish and Game releases every year?
No, from the hatchery, it's probably in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of little tiny fish. And then depending upon the survival rate, I think this year they're up to somewhere around 3,000 or 4,000 steelhead that have actually returned to the hatchery.
Mm-hmm. And that's the return is the same, a similar process to salmon who return to the place of their birth to spawn.
Yeah.
Except that the hatchery fish are spawned in basically a laboratory.
Yeah.
Right. But do they return? I mean, is the laboratory at the hatchery?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So they are sort of coming home.
Yeah, it is a coming home, and we're interested in the native. We want them to come home to their natal habitat, okay? So which are the small creeks and streams that are tributaries to the Russian River? I mean, that's really the emphasis of the Steelhead Festival in Healdsburg. It's actually, if you look at the posters, it says Healdsburg Wild Steelhead Festival. So we really want to emphasize the wild. And the reason we want to do that is that we need to put emphasis on it so that we can get people to help us to help restore the habitat on the Russian. So that's the emphasis, is really on wild fish and not so much on the hatchery fish.
Now, you heard a lot about habitat restoration. I know that at Kivira, before Kivira sold, they'd done some, and they had, I think it was Steelhead Red.
Yep.
Yes.
How much restoration has gone on in this area in that way?
Didn't you play a part in that?
Yeah. Actually, Henry and Holly went, our trout, or at least Henry went to Trout Unlimited member, and to you, that's Trout Unlimited, and Fish and Game, and NOAA, National Marine Fisheries, and the Wentz put together a restoration plan and did, over the course of a few years, the stretch of their creek from, is it East Dry Creek Road down to the confluence with Wine Creek. And what that involved was putting, I'll just say basically, we didn't put logs in, but rocks, so that you put little weirs in with the idea that you collect sediment and spawning gravels, and then below that you have a pool, so you have water throughout the summer for the fish. So we did that, that's called the in-stream work, and then also there was a lot of native plant work done. For example, willow mats, where you go and harvest native willows, essentially weave them all together, and you water them throughout the year, and then you have willows growing, and that's important for many reasons. Provide shade, keeps the water cool. The salmonids, both steelhead and salmon, like coho and chinook that we have around here, really need cold, clean water. So the shade from the trees provides shade to cool, keep the water cool, and then when the leaves fall in, it provides materials for the bugs that the fish eat. And then lastly, the main thing that it does is it helps prevent the banks from eroding, as opposed to the old days where you might see along the Russian River, the old car body approach where people would just throw car bodies, and actually up on the Yale River you see railroad cars from the old rail line. Just there, they pretty much just threw them over the side.
Hmm. Amazing. So it's amazing we thought that way at some point. It seems so counter
to how
we think now.
A lot of it boils down to economics. You know, it was a lot cheaper for the farmer to take his old 65 Chevy and plaster along the creek to try and, what he was trying to do was keep his property, because if they lose their property, they don't have as much land.
Oh, so trying to have the creek not take over
his
property. Oh, interesting.
So instead of paying an engineer to design a project such as Kivera, and I don't remember the cost of the total project, it was tens of thousands of dollars. And then actually further up on the same creek, we took out an old culvert and put in a bridge, and that was about $120,000 just to install a bridge that's probably, I don't know, 60 feet long.
Mm-hmm. Now, has there been a lot of return on that investment in steelhead and trout habitat?
Has there been a lot of what? I'm sorry.
Return on the investment as far as the improvement of the fishery goes?
That's a good question. That's actually the infamous million-dollar question, in that there's been some monitoring work gone on, but there's a lot of that nobody really knows that answer, other than that over the last, since World War II, the fisheries on the West Coast in general, the salmon and steelhead have declined dramatically, mm-hmm. gone from millions, tens of millions, down to maybe tens of thousands.
And we haven't seen that reverse yet.
No. Yeah, I think that to reverse that, we have a lot more work to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that the interesting thing, as a river guide, this year, fishing steelhead, we've seen a lot of wild steelhead. Many more this year than we saw last year. So in a sense, that's very encouraging, because, of course, you can't keep or take a wild steelhead. It's catch and release. And you can only keep the hatchery. But
how do you tell the difference?
Well, there is a fin. It's called the adipose fin, which is between the dorsal and the caudal. The caudal is the large fin in the back. The mm-hmm. dorsal is the large fin on the top. And there is this fatty tissue, which is called the adipose. Now, at the hatchery, they clip a high percentage of those so that when they're released into the river as smolt, it doesn't grow back. So when they come back from the ocean, those that survive, you can identify the fish that way.
Oh, they're missing that little...
Yep. They don't have that little fin.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah.
I think the other point that's important, and you know, we talked about how salmonids migrate to the ocean. That's the other great mystery, is what's going on in the ocean, because the fish only spend a part of their life in fresh water, mm-hmm. but the majority of their life they're out in the ocean eating food to get ready to come back in. And with the changing climate change, a lot of people are starting to argue that the changing ocean conditions are having a dramatic impact on the fisheries also, not just what goes on terrestrial, that is on the land, it's also what's going on out in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole other debate about that I've heard recently about with the protection of marine mammals, that because they proliferated as a result of not being hunted, that they're affecting the fish. So people have advocating, you know, well, why don't we start killing some of the marine life?
Start killing whales?
There's a lot of,
seals.
It's primarily the seals.
Oh, seals.
Seals
yeah.
can be... I don't know if you've seen, you know, up in the locks in Seattle where the fish the seals just destroy the fish. They sit there. The fish swim by the fish ladder, and they like to play with them and rip them to shreds and not necessarily eat them. So So
the cats of the sea, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah, I'd like to chime in on that. Being a guide and having worked on commercial fishing boats, I remember working on salmon trawlers out of Westport, Washington, and the skipper that I worked for was an old Norwegian sailor. His name was Otter, which was very appropriate. He had lived on the ocean all his life. He had immigrated from Norway during the Second World War, and it fished all of his life. And I remember when I first came on the boat, I asked him, I said, "Oh, you have a rifle, right?" And he looked at me and said, "What for?" And I said, "For the seals." And he said, "Well, what the seals get, they get, and what I get, I get." You know, and it wasn't a question of they were an adversary or that ultimate predator. I think that the ultimate predator, really, in the world of salmonid survival, is the two-legged human being. Okay, we're the ones that have destroyed the habitat and brought salmonids not to their knees, but we've ruined their habitat, and now we're paying for it. Mm-hmm. You know, in millions and millions of dollars. So I don't find I just don't like that. I don't. It's a great opportunity to say, hey, look, let's worry about the real issue. Let's worry about the ocean, the chemicals that are being pumped in the ocean, you know, all the plastic, all the styrofoam mm-hmm. that they're feeding on in the center of the ocean. Let's worry about drift netting. Let's worry about people that are poaching in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And those are real considerations, not to pick on something that is natural to the ocean, because it just takes our attention away from what the real issue is. And it's human. It's human beings. It's nothing. The predators are predators. Uh-huh. Chinook salmon can swim 35 miles an hour. And believe me, if you've ever had a 40 or 50-pound salmon on the end of your line, they're quite capable of taking care of themselves, you know?
That's fast.
You know, so that's very, very fast. And they're as fast as seals, okay? So... I just wanted to make that point. Okay.
Well,
that seals
you.
Are not, in my mind, uh-huh. they never have been the issue, and they're not the issue. Mm-hmm. That's really a distraction.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's a fishing scapegoat, I guess you could say.
Okay.
I mean, it's, Kent's point is spot on. It's the way we do our work. It's a watershed approach. Everything flows downhill. So what starts at the start of the up of the ridges up in Ukiah or down here in Roner Park or Santa Rosa, Sebastopol, it all flows into the Russian River watershed and out to the ocean. So everything we do, everything the listeners do, affects the watershed.
Let me think of an example, because I often wonder about exactly that sort of thing, and it's probably easiest for me to personalize it. Where I live, which is probably 150 yards above a portion of Atascadero Creek, then there's a road up above me. And that road goes down to the creek. And, oh, God, it's been quite a number of years now, maybe 15 years. That road was paved, and went that road up above me. And when that road was paved, it changed the runoff pattern so that now when it rains badly, I have an assault of water, whereas before I wouldn't, and you wouldn't think, looking at where I am, that there would be an assault of water. But now it's running off, and, you know, the water comes up above the step to my back porch and stuff. And I'm always looking down at Atascadero Creek thinking, well, how is this affecting the watershed? What just happened with that movement of water? Anything? Is it better for him, worse for him? How can just the average person who just lives in the midst of water look at, say, a situation like that and understand?
Do you want to go with...
And if you can't, that's okay.
No. Well, it's important. I mean, it's actually an important issue with the watershed, watersheds in general. We all live in a watershed, okay?
Right.
We
it's impossible
live in a watershed,
not to.
And that's the point.
Yeah, it's like, which
and
one?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if Atascadero, so we're talking about the Russian River watershed. You're part of that mm-hmm. watershed. The concern, I mean, you've basically targeted there are two things going on. One, at one time, it was paved, and the question is, and Rob deals with this a lot, decommissioning old logging roads or old roads in general. I mean, they're really a problem. Okay, they're a great problem because of that very fact, the thing that you mentioned, the runoff. Historically, roads were built. They didn't cant them off to the inside of the bank. They canted them away so all the water would run over the bank. So there you go. You get this water flowing over the bank, eroding away the bank down below, and it just keeps, you know, cycling down until it reaches a creek. Mm-hmm. The creek gets all muddy. So let's say you've got it's January on Austin Creek, right, which is down the road here. Well, you have fish come in to spawn. They spawn. All right. So when they spawn, the female makes a nest in the river, which is called a red, with her tail. I mean, it's rather incredible the energy these fish have. She makes the nest, deposits her eggs. The male deposits his milt. She kicks the gravel back over the top of the red, stays around for a couple days protecting the red, all right? And then you have a major flood event, okay, from the ridge. All the mud comes down, so what happens? The sediment buries the red. So no... there will be no survivor. I mean, there will only be a few fortunate survivors, okay? So the equation, it's important to pay attention to the whole issue of runoff.
Uh-huh. Okay, yeah, the impact of it. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah, the impact is it's decimating. I mean, it's terrible. We suffer.
Yeah, the runoff impact, if you think, imagine you're in... parking lot, we'll just use Coddingtown for fun, or the plaza, wherever you work. Whenever it rains, all that material in the parking lot, all the drippings from your car, typically goes down a storm drain into a creek. There are some new approaches of landscape where that runoff goes into a small area with plants, and it degrades the oils and such, and then the water just percolates in. But when you expand... say like these coasters we have here, or just even the roof, if you expand that to how many people live in Sonoma County, have all the impervious surfaces, the roads, houses, etc., instead of the water allowing to percolate in and soak in, it just runs off really fast. So you can have problems like Kent mentioned with sediment, chemicals, and then just the speed of the water. It all flows to a Tascadero Creek, or there might be another creek that's been channelized. It goes a lot faster, and the fish, it's too fast for the fish, so they can't even swim in it. So there's lots of different things that can affect fisheries from a runoff, like you said, at your house.
And fishery populations.
Yeah, I think it's important to have discussions like this, too, because, you know, everyone's talking about the rain for the last several weeks, but when you look at the there's all this rain, and you look at the landscape, if you haven't heard discussions like this, if you don't have this information, then the landscape isn't as detailed. You can't read it in quite the same way. So that's one way just to say thank you for elaborating on that.
Another simple way to do it, and they don't want you to do this because it's wasting water, but if you're washing off your driveway, just watch just from your hose for 5 minutes, or even when someone's washing their car or cleaning. I've seen people cleaning off their off-road vehicles or whatever, and it goes, you see all the silt going in the drain. Mm-hmm. It rains, that goes into the creek, and that eventually gets flushed down to other places.
Interesting. We're talking about trout environment, the watershed, and the upcoming Healdsburg Wild Steelhead Festival here on Mouthful.
Fishing all of the time, baby going fishing too. Bet your life, your sweet wife will catch more fish than you. Men plenty fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait. I'm a-going fishing, yes, I'm going fishing, and my baby going fishing too. I went on down to my favorite fishing hole, baby grabbed me a pole and a line. Threw my pole on and caught a 9-pound catfish. Now you know I brought him home for supper time. Proving any fish bites if you got good bait. Here's a little tip that I would like to relate. Many fish bites if you got good bait.
It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan. We're talking about the Russian River, rainbow trout and steelhead trout, the interconnectedness of it all. And Chris, you had a very interesting question, and it's one I think anyone who hears just a little bit on this subject wants to know.
Right. It amazes me how they're born. They go down. They go out into the ocean. And by God, they come back the next year to the same spot they're born. How do they know?
Yeah.
It's just wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that, how do they know?
Well, no, before you answer, just real quick, do trout come back the next year?
No.
Because you said a year later.
No, it's not a year.
Yeah, because I know salmon, what, 5, 6, 7 years sometimes for salmon.
Yeah, they have.
It depends upon the species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Each species. Primarily, what we're talking about with the Russian River, we're talking about Chinook, the coho or the silver salmon, right? Which Rob's project, he's the project manager. He works with the coho recovery program. And then we're talking about the seal, the steelhead, not the seals. they have a mind of their own. And I don't think they're really as creative. I shouldn't say that. That's not true. They're actually very creative.
Yes, they are.
But, well, that's been an age-old question, you know, how do they know, right?
Yeah.
But I think that, not to get too cosmic here, how do we know a lot of things? The fact is that they map. They're doing mapping, okay? They're very sophisticated. They have a sense of smell that's extremely acute. They also have, down the side, when you see a rainbow trout, right, you think of this beautiful kind of a rainbow when they're ready to spawn, kind of pink line down their side. It's called a lateral line. And they can actually, in the river or in the ocean, they feel on that lateral line. They can sense. So they're very, very sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're very sophisticated. And the steelhead trout in particular is an incredible athlete. I think they can jump like almost 10 feet, you know, which... that's pretty high.
It's high of a basketball hoop.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're very athletic and they're very sophisticated in their sensory perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always been the thinking is that they also use the sun and the stars for navigation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they just don't hang out down here at the mouth by Goat Rock. They travel all the way up to the Bering Sea. Okay, and out to the sea, out toward Japan, and then they stay probably they're in the river for probably a year. Steelhead, anyway, they're in the river for a year, and then they go to sea, and then they stay in the ocean. Probably, what is the half pounder? I think the half pounder is only goes out for a year and turns around. So that's a small. Mature steelhead comes back in the fresh water after being in the ocean just for a year. Okay, and those fish in particular are very prevalent up on the Klamath River, and there's a whole fisheries built around the half pounder up there. Let's see. Now, whereas, okay, since we're talking about how do they know now, for the what's interesting is that the steelhead. Stays in the ocean 2 to 3 years and then returns to spawn. Now, after the male and female have spawned in the river, they work their way back to the ocean. Now, I've heard that up to 4 now to survive. In and out, for example, in the river, pretty indeed, you know, varying feet. And now then decide to come. And also have Jack Sam, a 2-year-old salmon. It comes in the river. It is fully mature. but it is about the size of a steelhead, of an adult steelhead. It's smaller than its counterparts. Okay.
How many inches is that?
Maybe 20 inches. Mm-hmm. Okay. A jack is maybe 20 and weighing up 7, 8 pounds, you know, mm-hmm. maybe a little bigger. But, and they have an extremely important role in the preservation of salmonids because the jack is small enough where the big adult males mm-hmm. cannot get through, for example, if there is low flow. They can't get through the creek. Well, the jack can get through the creek because it's small enough and agile enough. So if the female can get in and dig the red and there is no large male there, mm-hmm. it can fertilize that red and then move out. Okay, but the point being is that salmon do not survive. Once they come in to fresh water, they do not return to the ocean.
But trout do.
The steelhead does.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's actually they're an incredible creature when you think about the transition that they have to make physiologically.
Yeah.
Right, because they go from being in salt water, then they have to make the transition to coming into fresh water.
Uh-huh.
Right, sure. And then they back their way out the river uh-huh. Fresh water back to salt water. So it's really, I mean, they're really interesting and beautiful creatures. You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And even over time, when you think about what salmon have been around, well, 10 or 20 million years,
yeah.
based on the fossil record. I'm a geologist also. But when you think about they developed on the West Coast, they're actually the Ring of Fire, if you want to expand it that much, that's the range of steelhead, coho, and chinook and other species.
That's the range, the Ring of Fire?
Basically.
I love that.
You know, we should get some Johnny Cash on here then. anyway, I got to stop. Let's see. Yeah, so basically they're in the same area as the Ring of Fire, and so they've evolved with the evolution of the Pacific Ocean, essentially, and it's an active margin with volcanoes and earthquakes and landslides and all those types of things. They've survived for 20 million years, and then as we discussed earlier about in the last 150 years, with the human activities on the West Coast, whether it be mining, timber harvesting, agriculture, road building.
Gravel mining,
they've been hammered really hard. And I'm actually amazed that there's still any left, just because of when you see some of the pictures of these watersheds from the North Coast that where they literally, and this happened in Austin Creek locally, literally there were train tracks running right up the middle of the streams. And then you look at these streams, it looks like a gigantic forest fire came through. And you go up there now, and you'd never know that any of that had occurred. And that the salmon have been able to survive not only for 10 or 20 million years, but these really intense, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, over the last 150.
Yeah, I think that what I would like to add is if you look at Mount St. Helens, okay, now what happened to Mount St. Helens is when it erupted, it completely, didn't completely, but inundated the Tuttle River. Okay, and the Tuttle River is historically a salmonid habitat. And so the river was essentially wiped out. And now, today, salmonids have returned to that river. Okay, so the point being that if you have a healthy watershed and a healthy habitat, these fish will survive.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't blame the seals, okay? Because if you're blaming the seals, you're in deep denial. You know, you've got to get it together here. Seals aren't really the problem. If you think they are, then gee whiz.
And now you know how trout and Ring of Fire fit together. Only on Mouthful.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
It's Mouthful. We're talking about trout and salmon habitat. One thing that we haven't touched on yet, and I think that it's a good thing to touch on, especially since Mouthful is sort of about food. We talked about humans messing up the ecosystems and that sort of thing. What about eating fish? Is it overfishing? Is the fact that people eat too much, or is that we just don't treat the environment as best we could, or both?
Well, yeah, I think you're right. It's really both. Okay, I think that there are two equations, right? We have to look at the habitat, and then we have to look at overfishing. So, I make a living from fishing, and so it's a delicate rope to walk. You know, I mean, basically. I mean, I make a living from it. I take people out that who probably would never fish unless I took them. So I'm encouraging them to fish. But what I think that really the way to define it is, so we don't waste fish. People eat the fish that they take. And if they, I always ask them, if they want to take the fish, that's fine. If they don't want to take it, which means kill it, then release it. That's really my approach. But I think there are other issues, and we're looking at commercial fishing. I think that we have to look at commercial fishing and address overfishing in that realm. Because I'll tell you, having worked on salmon trawlers, we, on the average, probably kill maybe 75 to 100 salmon or immature steelhead a day, right? They're called shakers. In other words, they're fish that are taken. They're incidentally, you know. And when you troll, you're dragging lines, and hey, you drowned them.
Yeah.
So you're wasting. So there, I mean, the issue
I guess we call it bycatch.
Yeah.
And one thing I'm always telling Mouthful listeners, and we've done several shows, and we'll do more. The Seafood Watch that Monterey Bay Aquarium puts out, that guide is a real quick and easy way. If you wonder, okay, I think this tastes good. Should I eat it, or is the fishery not in good enough shape? And that's really it. Enjoy fish as long as they're. As long as their habitat is okay and they're thriving. You all are so interesting. I could just be a fish geek with you for hours. But
okay.
We've got to talk about the festival itself. First, real quick question, why now? Is there something happening now that it makes it a good time to celebrate?
Well, actually, yes, because in Healdsburg we need something to celebrate about.
Okay, but and I mean, are the trout doing anything right now?
That's a good question.
It's... Yeah.
Well, actually, we're celebrating for two reasons.
Okay.
One is that we're in steelhead season.
Okay.
Right? February is the peak season for steelhead. Okay. So steelhead are in the river now and in headed for their natal spawning grounds. The other thing is that the Board of Supervisors last year, 07, declared February steelhead month.
Oh, okay.
And so that's really the inception of the event. That's how the event came about.
Okay.
A number of us were sitting around, and actually it was Merritt Shear of the Hotel Healdsburg said, you know, we should have a festival. And we all kind of looked at each other and said, you know, you're right. Let's do it.
Okay, no.
So here we are.
Okay. Now, Chris, you have Irish Rose Inn.
Right.
Where's the inn?
On Dry Creek Road in Healdsburg, right by the Dry Creek, where the fish in the back, I was telling them today, they were jumping out there 2 days ago.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And I belong to the Healdsburg Coalition, Lodging Coalition, and that's where it started with us because we wanted to help them with this, and they came to us, and actually he came to our meeting and presented this, and we said, let's go for it. So we've got all this gala planned for next weekend.
Okay, and so the inns who are involved are doing special packages for people who want to come and stay during the festival?
Yes.
Okay. And then I know that Dry Creek Kitchen is doing a dinner, probably sold out, on Friday night?
Yes, but still call because, you know, anything can happen. I want you to go ahead, and Chef Mike Ellis is going to, he's put a beautiful dinner together. And then, you know, Saturday under the tents, what's going on?
Now, this is under the tents downtown Healdsburg. Whole bunch of stuff. There'll be cooking demonstrations on fishing and fly fishing. No, fly tying.
Yes.
Both, actually.
Okay. Now, when you have the fishing pond for kids, how does that work? Is this catch and release?
It can be. If people choose to catch and release.
Or it's catch and cook.
Well, catch and cook. I think catch and cook is a little better, given the fact that we're stocking the pond with 800 to 1,000 rainbow trout. And I personally don't like the idea that people catch them and then they release them and they catch them and they release them. It's kind of torture.
That's pretty traumatic for the fish.
Yeah, it's not a good policy, and I would much rather see people catch fish and then take the fish.
Okay.
Okay.
And you just mentioned catch and release, so I wondered.
I think they're going to have the ability to cook them right there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Behind the fishing pond's going to be underneath in the gazebo on the plaza in Healdsburg, and then somewhere in that vicinity, there'll be cooking facilities available so people can either put them in a bag and take them home, throw them back in the pond, which we won't encourage, or cook them and eat them right there.
That is so cool. I love that.
It's been a
come on up.
In speaking about the watershed approach, that also community plays a big role in this.
Mm-hmm.
And the community of Healdsburg has really stepped up. The Lodging Coalition, the Chamber of Commerce, the Hotel Healdsburg, and contributed both hard dollars, which is a big thing, and a lot of complimentary time donations is the word I'm looking for.
Now, I also see some of the things going on include educational booths with Trouts Unlimited. You going to be there talking?
Yes. I will be.
Uh-huh.
Kent's going to be doing the pond.
Yeah, you're doing.
We're doing. Yeah, it's kind of a switch. We get tired of doing the pond, then we go to the booth, and then we do what we call the dog and pony show at the booth.
Okay. Now, is there an admission charge?
No.
No, so people can just come.
It's free for the event on Saturday. The gala dinner on Friday night is $100.
Yeah, correct.
All inclusive, and then actually the dinner Saturday night that the Lodging Coalition is also putting on is, I think it's 110.
Mike Mattson, Chef Mike Mattson of Vintage Valley Catering is having it at Vintage Valley Catering. And it is $110, and there are some seats left there.
Okay. And for people who want information, you can go to HealdsburgSteelheadFest.org. That's HealdsburgSteelheadFest.org. And that is happening on February 8th through the 10th. There's also, I'm sure there's a phone number to call. Vintage Valley Catering, if you're interested in the Saturday night dinner, is 433-9628. 433-9628. First annual?
Yes.
Okay. Watching a tradition be born.
Yes.
And there are we're all looking at the flyers here, and they're banners all over the light posts in Healdsburg and signs around town.
Okay. And then another thing, there's going to be wine tasting from fish-friendly wines.
Yes. Fish-friendly wines. There's a there's a program called, and some people, it's called Fish Friendly Farming. And essentially what that does is educates vineyard owners and wineries, primarily vineyard owners, of how to conduct their agricultural practices, that is, growing grapes with minimal to no impact mm-hmm. on the streams. And we're, as usual in Sonoma County, we're a leader in a lot of these areas. We have a captive audience here. People like to do good things, particularly when it comes to the environment. So there are a number of wineries that have instituted, I'll call them fish-friendly farming methods, and that can be as simple as not putting your road right next to the creek, your access road, mm-hmm. Moving it back, installing drip irrigation so you don't use as much water, eliminating or greatly reducing the amount of pesticides and herbicides that you use. There was up at, I think it was Preston Vineyards. Lou Preston has been involved mm-hmm. with this quite a bit. And it was very interesting because he had the creek, his access road, and then a whole bunch of non-native plants, which I thought was kind of curious, and then his vineyards. Well, it turns out the non-native plants, the way they're planted, is that the bugs that go from the vineyards or that are bad from the vineyards going to the creek don't go past the bushes, say, on the vineyard side. And the bad bugs from the creek going to the vineyards don't go past the bushes on the creek side. Huh. And so that's one component of it. So there's quite a bit of that. Uh-huh. Caveira's been involved with it. Another sponsor of the event and also who Trout and Lemon has worked with, in addition to Caveira, is Michelle Schlumberger. Mm-hmm. They have little enclosures. I saw I was out there the other day. They have little enclosures, and they put their sheep in there. And the sheep walk around and eat the weeds and the bugs, or they use goats, mm-hmm. and then they just move it around.
Mm-hmm. So fish-friendly wine doesn't mean wines that taste good with fish. That's another whole subject
correct.
Entirely. It's, yeah. it's good environmental practices. Now, I know that this is the Wild Stillhead Festival, that the emphasis on this whole thing is about the wild fish and not about the hatchery fish, but I can't let you be here and not talk a little bit about the hatchery. It's an interesting place. I remember going up there, I'm pretty sure, not long after 9/11 and seeing that it was closed for security reasons, hadn't followed it, hadn't realized that it was open again. But can we talk about both the function of the hatchery and what a visit involves?
Certainly. Let me go interject here real quickly. Lake Sonoma was formed by Warm Springs Dam. That was a long environmental battle in Sonoma County that went on for many, many years. And when the dam was built, that removed a lot of habitat for the salmonids, steelhead, chinook, and coho. So as a mitigation measure for the dam and the loss of habitat, the hatchery was installed. So initially, the hatchery was designed to produce steelhead, coho and chinook, and I don't know the exact reason, but coho and chinook at the hatchery didn't work very well. So right now, it's primarily, actually exclusively, I think, a steelhead facility. So the steelhead come in to the facility. The technicians take them out, and they do their thing to get the eggs from the females, and then they milk the males, and they all mix it up. It's like in a little colander. It's actually kind of weird. I mean, from a cooking perspective, it's kind of odd. And they mix them all up, and then they put them in tanks and bubble water through them, and the fish grow from the eggs to, smolts.
Yep.
Probably about, 4 or 5 inches long, and then they let them go. They take them out and put them in the river in different spots.
What happens to the ones that they get the eggs and the milk from?
I don't know if they give them away. I don't know what they do with them.
I do. They take them and they take them back out to the river, and they put them back in the river, okay, because you have to remember that even though they've been spawned, they'll survive.
Right.
So you have to return them to the river so they can return to the ocean.
Okay, so that's what happens to them.
Right, right. And there are places on the river that they're returned to, and mm-hmm. and people will go there and target them, which is not really a great idea because the fish has been spawned, and once you spawn them, they're not very tasty. But
And they're probably sitting around with their buddies talking about being abducted by aliens or something.
There's probably a far side out there somewhere.
Yeah. That has to just be a weird experience from the fish's point of view.
Yeah. I'm sure it is. Yeah.
I think it's with the females, they put up like a little high pressure air thing in them to kind of blow them up to get the eggs out.
Oh my.
I would encourage the folks listening to go take a tour of the hatchery. It's just a fascinating place of just, I don't know, from the scientific aspect, mm-hmm. I guess.
And do we have details about when it's open to the public? Do we know, or should we just
no.
give the... Okay, so it's
there
the Don Clausen Hatchery?
Yeah.
Sonoma County Don Clausen
yeah,
Hatchery?
Yeah, and Visitor Center.
Visitor
right.
Center.
Right,
and if
right.
you go, if you let's see, Lawrence Speedo on the keyboard is... Googling that right now. Now, is it connected in any way to the festival?
Actually,
they're going to go. They're taking a shuttle bus.
Yeah, they're going to have tours of the hatchery.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you'll be able to take a look,
yes.
a trip up there. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Actually, what I'd like to interject really quickly, in addition to the hatchery, what's been going on in the Russian rivers, because coho salmon and the Russian are essentially extinct. There aren't very many left, if at all. And 5, 6, 7 years ago, government agencies went and collected, and this was all made big science experiment, where they went to various places and collected wild coho, brought them back to the hatchery, and they did all the genetics, the DNA, the fingerprinting, all that, and did this incredible matrix of taking, you know, fish 300, oh, we're going to mate it with fish 367. So they would mate these, and what they're attempting to do is reestablish wild or runs of wild coho in the Russian River.
Cool, so and you're involved in that program.
Yeah.
And actually that program is going on up at Don Clausen Hatchery.
Oh, it is?
Okay, yeah, but it's isolated.
It's
from,
in the back.
Yeah, it's back in the lab.
Okay.
Okay. And it's a great program, and I've actually got to participate in the release up on Gray Creek.
Mm-hmm.
They release the fry in the spring, and last year I had the honor and the privilege of helping do that up in Gray Creek. So it's great. It's a great program.
Okay. And on that note, we are out of time. What'd you find, Lawrence?
Nothing.
Okay, Lawrence hasn't found anything yet. But you can all, you know, I always forget to tell you, you can send me an email. catsmilk@sonic.net is the easiest one to remember. And I would like to say thank you to our guests. And
you're welcome.
Let's see, we have Rob Dickerson, the website for Trout Unlimited, TU.org. And that'll get you to the Sonoma County.
That's actually our national website.
Okay.
Go to Redwood Empire. TU.
Okay. RedwoodEmpireTU.org for the local. Chris Mattson of Irish Rose Inn, and that is the Irish, let's see, the Irish Rose Inn .org. No.
The Irish Rose Inn .com.
I can do that. And then we didn't even get to talk to you about what it means to be a fishing guide. You have to come back because I'm really curious
I'd love
about
to.
That. Macintosh fine. Fishing Guide, Kent Macintosh, 1-800-4-CATCH-1. MacintoshFishingGuide.com. Time is up. See you next week on Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes. Support for Mouthful comes from KRCB Radio members and from Netbooks, complete business management software for companies up to 50 people, including wineries and food producers. Information available at netbooks.com or by calling 86-NET-BOOKS. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher said.